Welcome to Simplify. I'm Caitlin Schiller.
And I'm Ben Schumann-Solar. What's up, Caitlin?
Hey, Ben. Doing pretty well. Getting kind of hungry. So we're going to have to get in and get out really fast, guys, because I when I'm hungry, I'm not nice to be around. Nobody wants that. But today we have another one of those like very interesting kind of different Simplify episodes, because we have somebody who you wouldn't know his name, but I bet like 98% of you know his product. And he is the entrepreneur behind, one of the entrepreneurs behind, an app that I know and love and use all the time, Shazam. If you don't know, Shazam can, you can have it on your phone or your computer. You can let it listen to a song that's playing and it will identify that song for you, which is so useful. But Dheeraj Mukherjee is the founder of Shazam. He is now what is referred to as an impact investor that really focuses on social good, things like equality and clean water, you know, that good stuff. And his bread and butter subjects are entrepreneurship and investing, as you might imagine. And that is exactly what we talked about in this interview.
Yeah. And the thing that I would ask people, I mean, I agree we should roll the tape.
Yeah.
The thing that also stuck out to me was a lot about intuition.
Yes. I love
and
that.
About youth.
Yep.
And anytime you have a chance to hear the story of somebody who started something as universally impactful as Shazam is like a blessing. And I don't know, there's a whole lot in here, but we'll only have time in the end, I guess, to pull out a couple things.
Yeah. But we'll do it. I also just want to say one of the nicest people I've talked to. Thanks for being such a good interview, Dheeraj. He was lovely. So I hope you enjoy it. Let's just get right in there and we'll be back with some book recommendations and to do a little bit of a wrap up. Hi, Dheeraj. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, Caitlin. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Absolutely. Such a pleasure. So you are co-founder of Shazam, which is the world's first mobile phone-based music recognition service. I am reading that directly off of paper here, but all I think probably everyone listening knows of Shazam. I use Shazam a couple times a week. And you are also an investor, among many other things. But how do you like to be introduced?
I love being introduced as co-founder of Shazam just because it's one of these services which has been around since the age of the dinosaurs. We started in 2000 and, you know, my kids use it today. But really what I am now is a tech for good investor. So I try to invest in startups which are trying to, you know, create a better planet and make the world a better place. So that's how I like to think about myself and exploring the future and, you know, what lies ahead.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Then that actually ties into kind of the first area of interest of mine here in your work. I've done a little bit of background reading on you and listening to some talks. And I like that one of the things that you say is that the best way to predict the future is to create it. And as an investor who's watching what's on the horizon and sort of trying to figure out what the needs of future humanity are, what kinds of innovations, from your point of view, does our human future most need now? Or what's on the horizon that's exciting you?
Well, I actually came to impact investing when I was at the end of my entrepreneurial journey. And basically what I learned is that there's so much that the world needs, which comes from the world of entrepreneurship or being able to, you know, think about solving problems. And actually, I was exploring what these topics might be and came across something called the Sustainable Development Goals, which was put together by the United Nations. And there's 17 different goals, ranging from, you know, climate action to addressing inequality to poverty, you know, clean water. And that, for me, creates a fantastic roadmap. And the good news is that there's lots of people actively involved in addressing these challenges. The bad news is that there's a ton of work to be done and the clock is ticking. But that's what I use as my sort of frame of reference.
Cool. I've actually never heard of these before. Do you know a couple of them off the top of your head?
I do. And the one which I'm most passionate about is number 13, which is climate action. But there's 17 in total. You know, equality is a big one. I can actually go and get the list if that would be useful. But in general, it's a comprehensive sort of framework to address the major challenges that we're facing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can link it in the show notes when people get to listen to this. We don't need to go through all them now. I think it's really interesting that that exists. I wasn't aware of it. And I think it's a great measure, really. But more generally, it strikes me as though the kind of investing that you do is clearly very values-based and purpose-based. In your mind, how are values and purpose and profit really related?
Yes, I think that what nowadays I'm seeing more and more is bringing together profit and purpose, whereas the old model of capitalism, if you will, was all about making your investors better off and your shareholders more wealth. And actually, I don't think that's fit for purpose anymore, because today's generation of entrepreneurs want more than just money or creating value. It's much more about having an impact on the world. And that's what, in fact, attracts employees. That's what actually wins over customers. That's how you get influencers supporting what you're trying to do. And this shift, I think, has been in place for a while. It's become more marked, I think, in the last 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. But I've had some experiences which made me change my thinking as well. So business people, but acting as a force for good rather than just for the profit motive.
Yeah, I see, especially in bigger companies, less of an emphasis on doing social good, and it just becomes more profit driven. And I also think this is another area of yours that I'm interested in hearing you talk more about. As businesses begin to scale, it seems to me that they spend less time really focusing on the human side of innovation and just look for what will make the most money. And it seems like that can run a company into the ground. So when you think about innovation, how do you decide, or how do you see what might be a good, worthy investment in innovation in the future?
Yes, the way I think about it is, how do you create the future that you want to be part of? When we started Shazam in 2000, we would hear music and we didn't know what that song was. And my business partners and I essentially set out to solve the problem we were facing ourselves. And we didn't realize how complicated it was going to be to invent the technology and launch the service and then grow it. But literally, we're trying to, you know, invent a back scratcher for our own itch. And that's the way I think of innovation today, which is, what's the future that we want to be part of, that we want to create? And who are the people who are actually coming up with the ideas which will create that future? And so it's driven by a desire for change. It's driven by, you know, a perspective on a society that we'd want to be part of. I've got kids as well. I've got 3 kids who are 16, 13, and 10. What's the world that we want to create that they will live in happily in the decades ahead? So that's how I start thinking about it. And the aspect of profit, which is vital here, which is, if a business is not profitable, if it's not sustainable, it's not going to be around. So it has to have customers, it has to, you know, make sales, it has to grow, it has to allow people to develop in their careers in order to make a long-term impact. So that's the way I think about it.
Yeah. So then you have this notion of weak signals, and you're always, I've noticed in your videos and your talks, that you're always so humble and quick to admit that you're, quote, no expert in impact investing, or you don't have a specific degree in that, although you did go to Stanford Business School, so I think that qualifies you. But what you do have is instincts, and one of those instincts that you've honed is to pick up what you call weak signals. Can you talk to me a little bit about weak signals and maybe give a few examples?
Sure. I think weak signals is about thinking about problems and then observing information which might not be directly related, but create a pattern if one pays enough attention. And the example I use is that, you know, we all have the same kinds of challenges through life, which is, you know, getting a job or saving money or finding the right relationship or, you know, making friends or staying physically healthy. And, you know, sometimes these problems are buried deep down and we can't really articulate what's bothering us. At other times, they're more explicit. And the best innovations come from solving these deep-seated problems. And often one will get ideas when one's not thinking about a specific challenge. So it could be in the shower or when you're walking your dog. And those are examples of sort of solitary activities. But other things come from conversations or reading a magazine you wouldn't normally read, or going to a museum and trying to appreciate art, even though you might not be an artist yourself. And I think that's really important for creativity, for innovation, for problem solving. And then with practice, one starts tuning into where answers might lie, not where you're actually looking for them, but something or somewhere which you haven't really thought about actively. And that's what I call weak signals, but it becomes a practice rather than just serendipity.
Yeah, when you said it's pattern recognition. It's about creativity. It made me think of all the many books I've read over the years for Simplify and otherwise about creative practice and how so much of innovation and new creative ideas comes when you least expect it. And it comes from getting out of your ordinary environment and allowing whatever that new environment stirs up in you. You know, it churns things that you already know, and it invites new thinking, and that, you know, it's creativity. And I wonder, so much of what innovation looks like in business these days, especially tech businesses, is not creativity, or it doesn't really seem like creativity. I've noticed there's so much testing and reliance on data and getting a perfect outcome from the data. Do you think that there's too much of a tendency toward skewing toward data and not toward intuition like you've been talking about, or can they coexist?
I think that we tend to look for clear answers, and data often provides good answers, and using one's analytical faculties gives one a sense of confidence. My degree is in econometrics, so I love numbers and data and analysis, but I think it's only one part of the story. The other part of the story is about using instincts and intuition, but that's much harder to pin down. It's much more difficult to quantify, and it's much more elusive if you want to promote that in an organization. And that's where I think we fail, because if it's difficult to measure or it's challenging to quantify, then we don't pay attention to it. And I think that is a major challenge, because actually crunching numbers and doing analysis is becoming easier and easier as machines get more powerful. We now have access to incredible computing as well as generative AI. However, I think that the aspect which is less easy to pin down, which is putting together patterns which one observes from quite disparate fields or from observations which are non-obvious, because it's harder to do, we don't do it as well. And I think what we should do more of is to, you know, what I call embrace our stupidity, which is, what are the things which we don't know? How do we get better at exploring the unknown rather than, you know, focusing on what we're already doing well? So that's my contention on bringing the two together.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I don't know if it's that we don't do it well. It's just that I think that actually a lot of people do pattern recognition, and artists especially do pattern recognition really well, artists, writers, but I just feel like there's become less value placed on those skills and more on, say, how to make a great prompt for ChatGPT.
Yeah. I mean, you've mentioned artists, so this is an example. So my daughter is an artist, and she's 17 years old. She's not working in an organization yet, but most organizations are set up for scale, for structure, for process. But They're not necessarily set up to manage artists. Even the term is a contradiction. How do you allow someone to be as creative as possible to express their talent, working in a team with other people who may not know where their true talent actually lies? And that's a different kind of challenge. And where I think I see analogies is in sports teams. And you'll hear top managers talking about going out and enjoying yourself as you put in a performance. And it's not about the rigidity which comes from certain organizational structures or certain playbooks. So I think it's really being able to do both, to have a mission or to have an overall idea of what you're trying to accomplish, but then allow that artistic and creative and dynamic expression. And that to me is, you know, where the future lies in terms of, you know, more fluid organizations.
Mm. Thank you. Interesting. So that maybe touches on another area of interest of yours that you've been working on lately, which is compiling kind of your lessons from the past as you look ahead and explore the future on how do organizations and maybe entrepreneurs, people who would like to someday have an organization, how do they adapt to the future? And what are some of the pillars that you've been noticing there?
Yeah, so I think of the three big kind of trends which are driving the future as, you know, tech, green, and youth. And it's somewhat obvious in the sense that, you know, we're surrounded by emerging technology. I see a much greater willingness and drive towards a greener future. And then youth is something which I'm passionate about. After Shazam, I went to work for Save the Children, and I learned about the power of youth. And I see a lot more, I guess, sometimes a conflict or tension between the generations, but there's a huge opportunity for collaboration as well. So those are the three broad themes that I see. And within each of those, I feel like I can see startups, I can see activity, I can see, you know, bursts of innovation and, you know, techniques one can use, I think, to become more adaptable to the future.
Two things. This is a very compelling phrase, the power of youth. I want to know what you mean when you say that. So maybe we could just start with that.
Sure. So the power of youth is that it's, you know, directly from the philosophy of Save the Children, which is if you give young people a chance, they will prove how much they can do. And I work with a super young team. And what I try to do is create a compelling vacuum. In other words, you know, pose a problem or ask questions which don't have a clear answer and let the young people on the team I work with go and attack that problem. And I think that generally, our society values experience. What I value is the original thinking, which comes from inexperience. So not looking at what's happened before and what might have gone wrong and ways of doing things which are set in stone, but using much more, you know, first principles and being able to come up with original thought because one has the opportunity to attack those problems. So that's what I mean by the power of youth.
I love that. That feels so optimistic.
I hope so. I call myself an eternal optimist because you have to be if you're an entrepreneur. There's no other choice. And I think the change makers of tomorrow are naturally optimists. And it takes a lot more than that to, you know, make a dent in the universe, as Steve Jobs said. But I think it does begin with optimism. And that's one of the reasons why I can really relate to young people, because you're naturally looking forward. You're naturally looking at making a difference in your life. You're not held back by baggage from the past or, you know, bad experiences or setbacks. On the contrary, it's an opportunity to make your imprint. And that's why I, you know, love working with young people. And I think it's a huge resource for more established organizations as well.
I love that. This is putting a smile on my face. I'm having a difficult time feeling extremely optimistic about the world lately. So this is a nice corrective. If you could go back and talk to young Dheeraj, how old were you when you founded Shazam?
So I was 30 years old.
Okay, that's pretty young. What would you, or if you could go back even before that and start preparing young Dheeraj for entrepreneurship, for this game, what would you tell him?
I had a professor at business school who said, you know, you are learning about analysis and you're learning about, techniques to be more precise in your thinking. But you'll find in your career, you will end up using your instincts more as you become more senior. And that phrase stuck with me. And I think that what I would think about earlier is, how do you tap into your instincts? How do you develop your own sensibility to be able to put two and two together and come up with five? And that's something which a conventional education system doesn't focus on. That's something which young people are not necessarily rewarded for. But I believe that it's a huge opportunity if one is allowed to develop that confidence in one's creativity and the ability to think on one's feet, to be able to react to a situation which might be completely unexpected, as well as just to be more adaptable to change. So I feel now with experience, I've got to that point. I would do even more of that when I were younger, or that's what I would wish for young people today.
I could not agree more with that, actually. One of the best gifts that I was given by a pretty seasoned audio producer, not even that long ago, I didn't learn to edit audio until I was in my early 30s, but he taught me how, and he took me aside and we listened to an hour of tape together. And I said, well, how do I know what to pull? How are we going to turn this into 20 minutes? And he said, well, what interests you? What feels like it matters? What jumps out at you? Underline all of those things when you hear them. And that's something that I do with my interns today. It's developing trust in your own instincts. And it was such a wild idea to me at the time, like, oh, just because I find this interesting, someone else right. might too. But right. it's kind of obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating because my team has just started producing shorts for YouTube. And, my wife and kids saw it last week and they said, wait, you're on YouTube? I mean, they didn't believe that, I'm almost 55. What am I doing on that platform? But my team has basically gone through and created little edits of things I may have said. And I asked Diego, my producer, I said, how do you choose like what you create in the short? He said, whatever I find interesting. It's the things which stick with me. And I thought, that's brilliant, because, I can talk all day long. I have no idea what's interesting and what's not. But for a young person to pick out the 20 seconds which they believe is meaningful for them is exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I don't think that it's something we can always do for ourselves. I think that it's really important to have an editor or a producer or someone to listen back and say, no, this has resonance for some reason. But being able, I guess that what we're talking about here is this confidence and this confidence in intuition and creative taste to a certain degree. And it strikes me that those are the same skills, or the confidence, creative intuition. That's what you use when you're investing too.
That's right. I think in investing, what you're looking for is character. You're looking for that person who doesn't take no for an answer, that person who, can just dust themselves off from a rejection and get up and go again. A team which sees, setback as a stepping stone and just moves on. And that you cannot use analysis for. That's where you don't have data. That's all about feel and judgment. And the best entrepreneurs that I work with have very different backgrounds, very different academic qualifications, but they all have this characteristic, I guess, of, I call it the mind of the entrepreneur. And that's what I look for when I'm investing. And over time, it's a relationship between an investor and an entrepreneur. You learn to complement each other. And as an investor, I try to be a shoulder to cry on, or help to, you know, look further ahead than you can when you're in the trenches building a business. And it's about, you know, partnership. It's about teamwork. And all of these things essentially develop over time as you learn about each other and see each other's strengths. And it doesn't come from, you know, upfront analysis or observation. So it's a very human game. And it's something which I think we will still be, you know, learning about in 1,000 years from now, which is how do you really figure out human beings and not rely on the easy metrics, which are often, you know, could be related to a specific business or a particular, you know, financial objective. Those are actually relatively easier compared to understanding human beings deeply.
That's such a nice human way to think about investing. I think that maybe I'm guilty of this too as a liberal arts kid. When I think of investment, I just think of, you know, balance sheets and, you know, how much money is going to be injected into a future project. But really there's so much almost like human counseling work behind it.
Yes, I think that, you know, being an entrepreneur is a lonely business because people can't really understand the pressure that you're under. And we went through some really difficult times at Shazam where we had to let people go, and including some really close friends of mine I'd worked with day in, day out for months and years. And when you go through those dark phases, you have to tell yourself, it's not the end of the world. This is just a business. This is not life or death. But when you come out on the other side, when you manage to get through, then you can appreciate the people who were there with you at those darkest points in time, who stood by you and who backed you. And actually, the only way to make an impact is if you're big enough, if you reach enough people, if you ship enough product. And it's not about, I believe, the money. It's about, in our case, the friendships which we built, you know, going through the journey. It's about people coming up to me and saying, I still love using Shazam today. That makes me so happy. It's about, you know, putting a smile on your customer's face and you can see it. It doesn't matter what business you're in. So I think that is my interpretation, my view on, you know, what business and investing is about. It's making that change you want to see happen rather than, you know, how do I get rich quickly?
Yeah. So I love Shazam. As I said before, I use it all the time. But another app that I use is called Merlin. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's basically Shazam for birds. Shazam for birdsong. And it's out of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And you can just go ahead and let it pick up the bird sounds around you, and you give it a location, and it sort of cross-checks what birds are likely to be in your area. And it's really very accurate. And I remember thinking, man, if Shazam didn't exist, I don't know if this would have existed.
That is such a great story, because I've been asked this question several times. Is there a Shazam for birdsong? And I've never been able to give a good answer. So thank you so much. I'm going to spread the word about Merlin now.
You're so welcome. I can send you a link later if you want. It's given me great joy.
Oh, it's fantastic to hear.
Yeah. So to take it back just for a minute to the adapting to the future, your pillars were green, I believe, youth and tech. Is that what
yes.
you said?
Yes, tech, green, and youth, but the order doesn't matter.
Okay, tech, green, and youth. So we talked about youth a bit, and I'm glad we did. That was a nice human-driven conversation. But let's go to tech for a minute. What are you talking about here when you say tech?
So I find that tech can be intimidating and confusing to some people, and you know, seen as an opportunity for others. And when I talk about tech, I think about you know, innovations that are not necessarily in our hands yet. So the expression I use is basically looking over the horizon to try to look forward and see what we might be using in 5 years from now. And I'm a big fan of, frontier technologies such as augmented reality or virtual reality, which is much closer to being in our homes and offices today than it was, 5 years ago when I first started exploring. The other aspect about tech, which is it's very easy to play with. So you can launch a browser and check out a website. You can download most apps for free and play with them. It's a little bit harder if you want to, buy a headset. But actually, most technology is in our hands. And if we have a chance to play with it, then that gives us a sense for what the future has in store. And this is where I find as well, which is with Generation Z growing up with social media or using generative AI as a matter of course in their everyday lives, it's quite different from older generations where it's more of a learning curve. So I think it's really important to, give oneself the opportunity to discover and play with new technology and actually have the permission to soak up what the future might look like. And that's what I believe makes us more adaptable once it enters the organization, the workforce, the office, or the home.
Mm-hmm. And I see that how youth and tech are intertwined there. How is green intertwined with those two?
Well, I had a personal experience, which was one of our major investors at Shazam was a venture capital firm called Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Bowers. And the partner at the firm was Al Gore. And he had written a book and made a movie about climate change. And he came and did a talk for us at Shazam, which was an eye-opening experience for me. So I realized in 2009, 2010, what was happening with global warming, as it was called at the time, and what each of us could do as individuals to make a difference. Fast forward, I think, to 2019 and the realization that Greta Thunberg brought to all of us about the urgency of the climate crisis. And that's why I spend a lot of my time focusing on climate action and climate entrepreneurs, because if we don't encourage climate tech to be developed and flourish, I think it's going to be a major, major challenge. So that's why I'm particularly passionate about that topic.
Okay. Dheeraj, if you could tell people who are listening one thing about how you see the future of innovation and entrepreneurship shaking out, what do you hope that they would focus on or take away?
So I'm an eternal optimist. I believe that as individuals and as businesses, we can make a big difference to the future. And, starting with capital. So as an investor, I try to, back startups which are aiming to make a difference. But we're all investors. We're saving for our retirement. We might have a pension and we can put those funds to work for causes that we believe in. But more than that, as customers as well. So, we can use our ability to buy products and services from brands and companies that we believe in. But even more than that is through connections. So whether it is a podcast like this where one can get a word out, or whether it is about putting a message on one's social media, or connecting with suppliers or distribution in other parts of the world, for instance. There's so much we can do both as individuals as well as organizations. So that's my main message, I guess, is can we create the future that we want to be part of? That would be my, I guess, closing thought or one takeaway from this conversation.
I love it. And also, it doesn't hurt to be an eternal optimist.
Well, thank you, Caitlin. I'm glad to hear that you're an optimist as well.
Oh, you know, I try. And one last thing I wanted to ask you about, because Simplify is nominally a book podcast, so this is a pretty unusual interview. You don't have a book yet, but you have a body of work out there in videos and in talks. But have you read anything in the recent past that you would recommend? It can be in your area of expertise that we've been talking about, or something else.
Sure. I just want to say I'm a huge fan of Blinkist. I love Blinkist because I absorb so much information in such a short time. I haven't written a book, but my dream is to be a Blinkist author, to write a book, which is straight to Blinkist. Maybe one day. Yeah. But the book which I loved recently is Bill Gates's How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. And I found it so clear, well-written, practical and optimistic. So that's one I thoroughly enjoyed.
That's high praise. Great. All right, Dheeraj, thanks so much for taking the time to talk today. This has been so good.
Fantastic. Absolutely my pleasure. And hope that you're able to get something useful for your listeners from it as well.
Oh, I'm sure we will.
Welcome to the bookend, where we end with books.
Wonderful. Hi, Ben. We're back.
Great. So impact investing, designing the future, youth, green, trusting intuition, being an artist, what innovation actually means. Yeah. Like how, what do you want to pull out?
This is very predictable. The part that I loved the most was hearing Dheeraj give advice to his younger self, which I think is such a valuable thing to hear from entrepreneurs, like people who have really done the thing. Ask them, what would you tell yourself 20 years ago? And his advice was invest in techniques and skill early on, because later on you'll use them to really hone your instincts. So like focus on the techniques and skills in the beginning, because they are what will inform your this cloud of a thing that we call intuition later in life, which is what makes you really, really valuable in your mid and later career. So he said, you know, things he would ask that younger self, he'd coach him to say, how do you develop your sensibility? How are you working on your instincts? And a conventional education system, I thought this was really interesting, he pointed out, does not focus on that. Right. It doesn't even really talk about, I can't remember ever talking about intuition or instincts, but so much of what makes you good at a thing you choose to be good at later in life is learning to trust your gut and tune into those things.
Yeah. And it's funny, like he said, that's both relevant the higher up you go career-wise, because you have to do more of that kind of intuition.
Yeah.
And I've also learned this in the kind of innovation development space in that when you're making new things, you can't rely on the way old things have worked. So you are always sort of guessing, which means you're doing some intuitive, you know, analysis, let's say. Intuitive analysis is a cool phrase I just made up.
But,
because you can't just say, well, this worked, so we'll do that. The point is you're making something new, so you can't say what's going to work. So that requires trusting, reaching some kind of wisdom, and you can use data.
Yeah.
The data is always backwards looking. You can.
It's true.
It's hard. So you have to always have intuition. And on the other hand, how he said, how do we instill this in the youth?
Yeah.
And how do we teach people? And whether that's like a child, like actually youth, or whether that's just a more junior person in your company, how do we help people practice that? How do we help people make contact with that, with that intuition in themselves, and train it and build it? And that is, I agree with him, that is probably the way toward a better future.
Yeah. Turning that, I think it makes me think of the coaching question, Michael Bungay-Stenier, like, he always turns it around. It's like, well, what do you think? Yeah.
Sweet. So should we do books?
Yeah, let's do books. I can start. I have a book called The Social Animal by David Brooks. Do you know this one?
Yes. David Brooks, of course.
Okay. So at the end there, Dheeraj and I were talking about intuition, developing the sensibility, knowing in a way that transcends logic and emotion. And what I love from the blinks to this book, The Social Animal, is this sentiment that rational choice is impossible without emotions. You cannot make a good decision without emotional reasoning, because emotional reasoning is actually the thing that allows you to imaginatively project into a future where you have made that decision, and it lets you feel how the decision might impact you.
Right.
Like an example of this is when you think about diving from a high cliff, you feel fearful, you feel like queasy, you feel panicky. And without the emotions that are informing those feelings, you would not be able to make the choice to not dive off the high cliff. So I really like how this book positions intuition and emotion as a part of rational decision making.
Yeah. There's a famous study, like I remember studying morality in university. Mm-hmm. And there was this study that people who had a part of the brain removed, like a certain lobotomy, where emotions live, were actually incapable of playing blackjack, of like making a rational choice of hit or stay based on the number of your cards, even if you told them what to do.
Yeah.
And when you have no connection to, like, just physically, biologically, when the emotion doesn't work, the brain rational system doesn't work, which is, very interesting.
Very interesting indeed.
I brought a couple things. I mean, Dheeraj did a guide on the Blinkist app called Investing for Impact. So you can check out the guide.
Absolutely.
In that guide, he mentions the book The Business of Good by Jason Haber. The subtitle is Social Entrepreneurship and the New Bottom Line. So maybe people have heard of something called, like, people call it Capitalism 2.0. The idea is social entrepreneurship combining profit motives with social problem solving. So basically, it's not only about maximizing profits. This book and his guide are a good starting point to look into it. It's not that complicated. It's in the name, social entrepreneurship. And like you talked about in the interview, it's not just about how do I make my name and my bank account as big as possible, but how do I do some good for the world?
Yeah. Nice. Great choice. All right.
Solid.
Then that is it. Hope you enjoyed it and got something out of that. Hope you'll go and listen to your intuition today. Simplify was produced by me, Caitlin Schiller, Ben Schumann, Stoller, Maria Levichek, and Stefan Obadiah here in Blinkist HQ in Berlin, Germany. If you would like to try Blinkist, which we highly recommend, you want to go check out Dheeraj's guide, you want to listen to those blinks, go to Blinkist.com/friends and enter the code IMPACT, I-M-P-A-C-T, IMPACT. All right, till the next one, checking out.
Bye-bye.